on the weekend panel today, Lavina Good joining us, the journalist and sports commentator. Kia ora, Lavina.
Kia ora, good morning to you both.
And Waikato University's Professor of International Law, Dr. Alexander Gillespie. Morena, Al.
Morena, John.
A highlight or low moment from the week for each of you. Do you want to kick us off today, Al, please?
For me, the highlight was the agreement between America and China to work more together on climate change.
I'll try and get to details of that before 9 o'clock. Okay, and Lavina?
I had a great day yesterday here in Tauranga. I went into downtown Tauranga and it's been looking a bit rough lately. There's so many places for lease and heaps of roadworks and it's not been that enticing. But yesterday there is a new sustainable hub that's been set up downtown called Remaker, and it's about getting people together that know how to reuse and recycle things and maybe sell them. And it's a real community hub, and it's the first time in a very long time I've been downtown thinking the future's looking good with Antolli as a commissioner, and it's looking good for Tauranga. So it was a great feeling at Remaker yesterday, and it's nice to know that downtown Tauranga has something to offer finally. It looks great.
Yeah, it's a great thing to mention too. Thank you. Alrighty, now people are asking me not to tell the score of the All Blacks game, but if we don't, Catriona will shortly. Ireland 29, the All Blacks 20. No one wanted to leave the stadium, reports the Irish Times. Did either of you watch the game?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, you
I
did.
Got up very early to watch the game. I was the only member of my family that set the alarm and decided to get up. I think as the children go through their teenage years, they're waning when it comes to All Blacks and live performances overseas, but it was a remarkable game of rugby. And I think what stood out for me, Jim and Ali, was the fact that the All Blacks were outmuscled and outsmarted by the Irish. So the Irish over the past decade have realised what they need to do to beat the All Blacks is play like the All Blacks. So their line speed was phenomenal. And they're a lot more aggressive. They're a lot more serious when it comes to training and preparation for these international events. And now they've played the All Blacks over the last six times. They've won three of them. So they're no longer that poor cousin. But what stood out for me were the All Blacks being overshadowed by a side that was bigger, faster, smarter, and more determined. So there's a lot there for Ian Foster, the coach, to think about, because they've also lost to the Springboks this season as well. So plenty for the All Blacks to work on, but not a bad thing for world rugby indeed. It was a tremendous game, and I'm happy that the Irish won.
Second in the physicality stakes, says the New Zealand Herald. All Blacks coaching predictable, says a listener. Al, we're not leaving you out of the conversation, but I just want to ask you one more thing, Lavina. Were you surprised?
I had a feeling that the All Blacks would be challenged by this one. I watched the Irish play Japan last week where they won by 9 tries, and I saw the style of play, which was just what the All Blacks don't like to play against, which is that intense line speed and putting pressure on the kicker immediately. And I had a feeling that the All Blacks would be flustered when it came to playing the Irish at Lansdowne Road, which is a mecca for the Irish when it comes to playing any rugby test match. So I knew that they would be challenged. I'm not as surprised as others, but I do think there's lots of questions that will be asked. When I rated the All Blacks players today, Jim, when I looked at them individually and rated them, there would have been maybe one player that got out of over seven out of 10 for me. And that's a rarity when it comes to rating players for the All Blacks. So plenty for them to work on when they play France next week, which will just as challenging.
Who was that player?
The Papali'i was the player. Yeah, right. He was outstanding. Okay. His defence was really, really good. But I guess it didn't hurt. I mean, it didn't help them when they lost Bowden Barrett in the first half, and there were injuries that concerned them. And the Irish only won really towards the end of the game. But at no stage throughout that game that I watched this morning did I think that the Irish were going to lose. They had too much possession, too much territory, and they put too much pressure on a side that is meant to be one of the best in the world.
Very good. And Al, as Lavina says, we possibly don't mind being beaten by the Irish compared with some other teams, and it does sound like it was a grand game.
Well, for me, it's probably the best team to be beaten by because my wife is Irish, and so that means that today is a happy household. it's the most tense time whenever the All Blacks play Ireland in my household.
And just really quickly, Lavina, will the Black Caps beat Australia tomorrow morning or not?
I have been fascinated by this tournament, Jim and Ali. When the Black Caps first lost against Pakistan, I think they only made 107 in the opening round, and then they had to beat India in the next game to make it through. And I really questioned how the organisation was of the tournament. I really thought it was quite poor, and, you know, the chance the Black Caps won't go through. But since then, they've really surprised me. I wasn't shy in coming out and saying that I wasn't pleased with the way Martin Guptill was playing, and I thought he should play down the line. But since then, he and the team have proved me wrong and played tremendously against England. But I guess for every New Zealand cricket fan, the team they don't want to play against in the final is Australia. They would have been pleased to have played against Pakistan, even though they lost against them. And I really do think, you know, when we were talking about the All Blacks and Ireland, that came down to a game of physicality and smartness. And I think with the Black Caps, they're the World Test champions. They've proved themselves on the world stage. They've got Kane Williamson, who is the best thinker and batsman in the world by far. It's come down to a psychological game. And the Black Caps have been hurt so many times by Australia. I don't think it's going to come down to skill set on the pitch. The Black Caps are great at cricket. It'll come down to psychologically thinking, can we beat Australia? And at this stage, without Conway and the way the Australian captain's playing, I wouldn't be surprised if it was an Australian victory.
Okay, matter. The great gridlock yesterday in Auckland, protesters slowing down traffic across all the main motorway lanes, a version of it in Wellington, a few thousand marching in Christchurch. So, are they awakening us to our lost freedom? Are they just being a nuisance? What's your view of what's going on and what police should do if this continues? Al Gillespie, what do you think?
I think they're being a nuisance, but we need to tolerate them. Protesting is part of who we are, up to the point that laws are broken or disorder breaks out. I think the police are doing a great job so far. I don't want to get to a situation of what you saw with the Netherlands last night where water cannons are used, unless you see lawless behaviour. To focus on those who are organising the events and bringing them to justice afterwards is the correct way to be going forward.
Okay. Keep letting them let off steam, Lavina. Do you agree?
Oh, it's frustrating though, Jim. I tried to get to town yesterday and there was a massive traffic build-up and it broke down traffic here on the main street in Tauranga for at least 45 minutes. So it's really frustrating, but I agree with Ali, you don't want to see cannons set off, or you don't really want to see people arrested. It's a sign of frustration by the people in the community as to whether or not, you know, the government's making the right decisions, and it's the only way that they can express themselves. But I tell you what, it drives you crazy when you can't get somewhere where you need to go. But I guess it drives them crazy when they don't want to be in lockdown anymore, or they don't want to be mandated when it comes to having vaccinations.
Okay, more than 3,000 people isolating at home from nearly 1,000 households. The daughter of a man who died without, it's claimed, enough medical support told NewsHub the government had a year to prepare.
My brother was doing CPR and there was just blood gushing out and no one took him seriously.
Andrew Little says a system that people had to fit into will now become a system built around the needs of people. But that has to become a reality, and the strain on primary care is obvious. That family's GP was evidently unable to help without guidelines in place. GPs are leaving the profession in some numbers. The complaint from the family is that the health approach is disjointed as Delta begins to surge. What do you both think of our state of readiness right now? Al, you again first, please.
I think our first line of defence has to be very high vaccination numbers, and that first line of defence is looking good. The problem's going to literally be the ambulance at the end of the street. How far we'll have success on that, I don't know. It will depend on the numbers and the surge. But for me, the big question now is that when we get past the next stage, 6 months on, we have a royal commission into this to make sure that the government has used the 18 months it had to prepare as best as it could.
Okay, Lavina.
I think a year ago when we had no cases for over a 12-month period, if the government had invested millions of dollars into trying to get more ventilators into the country and maybe even building more hospital beds, back then people would have said, you're crazy, we don't need it, don't spend money on that right now. But now, you know, foresight's great, hindsight is fantastic. But if we take a look at the country in a state of readiness with the health system, it does seem like the health approach is quite disjointed at the moment, and it's easy to say we should be buying more ventilators. I think we're only using 15% of the ventilators at the moment in the country, but we will run out of bed space if the vaccinations come to a standstill and more people get the coronavirus. And it's easy to say to people, hey, get vaccinated for others, but the real reasoning behind it, if you get vaccinated, the reason I got vaccinated was not just for me, but it was for family members that I was concerned about, but also how taxing it's going to be on our health service. I don't want myself or my family ending up in hospital, especially when we're running out of beds. So it does seem as though the government is having a panic situation at the moment. It does seem like the health approach is not really joined at the moment, but I guess it's just so hard to know what to do when we look at what was happening a year ago and no one was really panicking, no one really cared.
Yeah, and by the way, consternation and conflict as the Netherlands goes back into lockdown in the Daily Mail, in case you're interested in seeing what the situation is there. All right, there's a midwife shortage in places now, and rebel, if that's the right word, doctors, nurses, midwives have lost the fight in court to use the Bill of Rights to stay unvaccinated, citing the freedom to refuse medical care. They'll keep fighting. Al, are you satisfied they are wrong legally?
I think the judiciary is doing a fantastic job at the moment. I think that the applicants were mistaken and they got the result that could have been expected. The Bill of Rights does not contain absolute rights, as many people think that they do. My concern at the moment, though, is that a lot of the heavy lifting is falling on the judiciary. And I think what we need now is a single piece of legislation that deals with all of the questions about vaccination, about whether it's mandatory, about parents and children, about vaccine passports in public and private spaces. We need a bespoke piece of law now to deal with some of the most pressing questions of a generation.
Okay, let's talk about vaccinations. Auckland DHB could reach the magic 90% double vaxxed mark today, but a lot of people are yet to be vaxxed and have been given deadlines. Frontline police, district health board workers, a lot of them, people contracted to make hospital meals and drive patients and provide linen, firefighters, they've had an extension, daycare centres, one or two of them have closed down, anti-vax staff have left, staff at One King Country School banned from the classroom. The list goes on and on. And is there an alternative to the present course of action? Can you see us moving to the traffic light system pretty soon, whatever the outcome for the unvaccinated? What do you both foresee, Lavina?
We've had a daycare centre here in Tauranga closed down because of the teachers not wanting to be vaccinated. So that's a sign, first of all, of what might come in the future. I guess the mandatory levels of the government are being questioned all over New Zealand in terms of who should be vaccinated and who shouldn't be. It's all right for us to say initially, hey, vaccinate those on the port because we don't want cases coming in here from overseas, but we're beyond that now. And I think when that was first suggested, everyone said, great idea, great idea, great idea. And then as soon as it was mandatory for teachers and you're losing school teachers, everyone seems to be second guessing it at this stage. So I think it's a difficult, very difficult situation. The government might have to rehash their thoughts like they did on the pandemic when they first of all said, let's eliminate it. And now they're saying we won't eliminate it. We need to contain it. I agree the vaccination rates need to be high to make sure it's contained. But in terms of forcing people to be vaccinated when we're losing school teachers and firefighters, I think the government might have to second guess some of their decisions now, which is very difficult and confusing for people in the community. And what we really want is exactly what Ali just described, is a piece of legislation that is transparent, that explains everything to us all at once. That's what we really need.
Yeah, Al, what do you think a rehash might look like?
I think the question of mandates is a very difficult one, and we need to make sure that we've explored all the options and alternatives. And I think one area we need to look further at is the possibility of people who are unvaccinated returning negative tests on a regular basis. And it may be that we have to share the costs for those tests, but often to make someone lose their profession, it's a very heavy penalty, and it's something we should be reluctant to go down that path unless we've explored every other option. One point I would make, though, is that COVID isn't like a date on a yogurt tin that's going to suddenly come to an end. And this next wave we're going to come to will probably just be another part of a process. And so this law will evolve. Our question about mandates will evolve. And our responses is yet to come over the next few months.
Yeah, the government did consider and talk about the option you mentioned of testing the unvaccinated, and then things toughened up. Should the non-vaxxed have to pay for care if they get COVID? This is a poll reported on Twitter. Yes, 27.5%, no, 62.6%. Are you pleased people are forgiving of the unvaccinated, because they aren't so forgiving completely overseas? In Singapore, the unvaccinated pay for treatment. In various Western countries, they pay for their tests or have to take unpaid leave if sick. Would you both support that kind of approach, Al?
I would not support it. I think the unvaccinated are going to pay a very heavy penalty anyway. And I may disagree with what a lot of unvaccinated people say, but I would still support their right to get into hospital and help cover their costs if they get sick.
Lavina?
I had this discussion with some friends on Friday night as I was aware of what was happening in Singapore. I never thought I would say this, actually, but no, I totally disagree with Ali. I think if you're making a decision to not get vaccinated, you have to be fully aware of the consequences of those actions. And if you do end up in hospital, then you might have to pay for your care. I see only a third of the country is in favour of that, but it's come down to the fact, like I mentioned before, people need to get vaccinated, not just for themselves, but for others in the community. If you're not willing to do that, then you'll have to face the consequences. And I also read an article recently that said, you know, you can either get vaccinated by having the Pfizer jab at this stage, and that will give you a vaccination and also protect you from the virus, or you can get the virus and face the consequences of that. And if you do, then you might have to face the consequences of paying for a service to make you better again. I'm all over that. I'm all over that.
One more COVID question, because Whangarei ICU's clinical director says there may come a situation where a hospital is forced to assess which patients are likelier to recover and who to prioritise. And this throws up conundrums, Al. I mean, what if that were the unvaccinated patient? Would you support an unvaccinated 40-year-old with more living years being prioritised over a 70-year-old person double-jabbed? This is the possible future, I suppose.
I don't accept that kind of thinking about lifeboat ethics, where we've got to start choosing between our citizens. But I would say one thing, and that is age is not the sole determinant of value in these considerations.
Yeah, but it's hard to the determination, though, is hard, isn't it? I mean, making those decisions is terribly hard.
It is, but we're not at that point. And I think if we kind of pursue those kind of discussions, it suggests that we're going to have to start choosing between the vaccinated and unvaccinated. For me, the answer is to make sure that we've got the best lines of defence so far. We have more health professionals, we have better medical systems, and we don't get to the point where we have to say one citizen should live and one should die.
Okay.
I spoke to a friend of mine who's a nurse prior to the first lockdown, and she was called in by not the district health service, but by her bosses, and they said if it gets to the stage where we don't have enough ventilators, lots of people come into the hospital, there will be old people and there will be babies, and you will choose the babies for the ventilators over the old people. Nothing was questioned about whether or not people were vaccinated, but I guess when it comes to preserving life, there might be a decision made to preserve a younger life over an older life. I'm not sure, but it's scary to think that we even have to consider this. I do know that there would be fewer people in hospital if more people were vaccinated. I guess that's something that needs to be addressed first.
Okay. Al, I said we'd try and get to COP26, so we will a wee bit. We had a virtual APEC, of course, ourselves with a climate change pledge. And at COP26, the US and China agreed to drastic changes in clean energy by 2030. Okay, so you would like to talk about this. How will clean energy happen this quickly when the burning of fossil fuels has surged post-pandemic and when China has 70% of its electricity fossil-fueled and the output from its new coal plants exceeding all the coal output retired in the rest of the world last year, Al?
It's taken us 200 years to heat the planet up since the Industrial Revolution. Mm. It's going to take 100 years to get it cool again. Where we have achieved with COP26, although it could be better, we're walking on the right pathway. I think the work around methane is excellent. I think the work around deforestation is good. The cooperation between America and China is excellent. We aren't going to get there tomorrow. It's not going to be cool on 2030, but I think we've made significant steps in the right direction.
Lavina, what's your take of it? There's a big summary in the New York Times of people interested about what's been hammered out at COP26, which 200 countries have to agree to. What do you think, Lavina?
Yeah, I was reading that. I find it interesting. I agree with Ali, though. We're heading in the right direction with China having 70% of its fossil fuels being reduced is very important, and the output and stuff like that. We need to be conscious of what's happening overseas and also what's happening here, and we need to have a timeline in place. And I agree with Ali, it's not going to happen tomorrow, but we all need to make our own little difference, first of all, within a community, then within a country, and then at an international level. And a great point that Ali made about it's taken us a couple of hundred years to heat it up. We need to spend some time cooling it down. We'll have to be patient. But I think with the countries coming together and everyone heading in the same direction, and if we're governed to look to a timeline to what we have to achieve, I think we will be able to achieve it, especially here in New Zealand.
Very good. Lavina Good, Professor Al Gillespie, thank you for your company, both of you, on the weekend panel.